This is Talking History. Talking History is a weekly radio program focusing on history. It examines our past and how we recall it, how we preserve it, how we interpret it, and how we transform it into myth. Talking History is a co-production of the University at Albany History Department, State University of New York, WRPI-FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. Hello and welcome to Talking History. I'm Jerry Zahavi from the History Department at the State University of New York at Albany. In this edition of Talking History, we listen to Mark Solomon, Professor Emeritus of History at Simmons College in Boston. He's the author of The Cry Was Unity, Communists and African Americans, 1917 to 1936. The book examines the role of American communism in anti-racist struggles in the years preceding World War II. Solomon spoke at the Deerfield Progressive Forum in Deerfield, Florida on January 23, 1999. He begins with a reading from his book.
I was a white kid who went to a nearly all-black public school in the Bedford-Stuyvesant section of Brooklyn during the wartime and post-war years. And many of you, I think, in this room, I know, can identify with this. Many of the teachers, black and white, were radicals. And some were communists. Virtually all were driven from the school system in the McCarthy period, tragically eliminating a group of teachers committed to genuine equality and learning. Mine was reputedly a, quote, problem school, unquote. And teachers received some kind of bounty for teaching there. Those teachers, however, were not motivated by bounties, but by a consuming respect for the children and for their heritage. We celebrated the birthdays of Frederick Douglass and Paul Robeson. We marveled at Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth. We saluted the scientific achievements of Charles Drew. We sang James Weldon Johnson's Lift Every Voice at Assembly. Most of us knew its lyrics, its stirring lyrics, better than those of the Star-Spangled Banner. It's safe to say that such things rarely, if ever, went on anywhere else. And the decency and sensitivity of those teachers impressed me deeply. I was also drawn to the radical speakers who periodically parked their sound trucks and their brightly painted slogans by the subway near our apartment, and who spoke with passion for democracy and racial justice. I soon found myself on street corners soliciting signatures for the freedom of Rosalie Ingram, a Georgia mother and sharecropper who had been sentenced to death for killing a landlord while resisting sexual assault, and eventually mounting stepladders, to my parents' chagrin, to imitate the passion of those elder activists. Many who grew up in the 1940s and matured in the 1950s lived in a political milieu that was still strongly influenced by the Communist Party and its allies. The intellectual and political ferment in much of the movement for black liberation reflected that influence. I grew up with such towering figures as Robeson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and other lesser-known but inspiring figures of the African-American left who were on the scene. I tried not to miss a public gathering where either Robeson or Du Bois were scheduled to appear. I clung to Du Bois' words and dogged him through the corridors of the radical Jefferson School where he lectured in the early 1950s. With friends, I hovered over Robeson's recording of his classic Othello, wore out my album of his Songs of Free Men, and tremblingly sought his support in my sophomoric quarrel with administrators of a left-wing summer camp that he visited annually. I admired the insights of Dr. William Alpheus Hunton of the Council on African Affairs, who awakened an awareness of the rising anti-colonial tide in Africa. William L. Patterson was in and out of jail in those days, but never seemed distracted or short of patience with those around him. The courtly but distant James Ford was in Brooklyn, and Benjamin Davis, Jr., always eloquent and impeccable, was making fiery speeches to, quote, fellow workers, unquote, all over the city. There was Adam Clayton Powell arriving late and breathlessly at a public meeting, who enraptured his audience nevertheless and justified the near filibuster of his legendary fellow member of Congress from Harlem, Vito Marcantonio, who had stalled until Powell's arrival. Among my contemporaries were young people of enormous talent who were molded by the likes of Robeson, Du Bois, and the others. The remarkable playwright Lorraine Hansberry, the founder of the Negro Ensemble Company, Douglas Turner Ward, the novelist John Oliver Killens, as well as many others, who refused to be ground down by the McCarthy years, and who went on to productive work in unions, shops, university, law, and politics. The environment we knew was one of spirited demonstrations to save the lives of Rosalie Ingram, Willie McGee, the Martinsville Seven, and other victims of a racist legal system. It included attending vibrant interracial dances at Rockland Palace in Harlem, sitting in awe in the back of Birdland to ask Charlie Parker to support Du Bois for the Senate, and listening to Miles Davis engaged in by the unhip Labor Youth League, which somehow thought that Davis's brilliant elliptical bebop was right for dancing. All of that had nearly disappeared by the mid-1950s. But that defiant interracialism, grounded in the unity of cultural traditions, of shared support for all who labored for an end to oppression at home and abroad, never died. Its special commitment to and admiration for black culture, history, and community life survived and fused with a pervasive sense that the liberation of one group was essential to the spiritual and physical freedom of all. I believe that had the force of that experience flowed more strongly into the 1960s and into the present, a far greater degree of black-white unity could have been achieved. That experience and legacy, for better or worse, informs this work and shapes the author's point of view. And so we began with that background and sensibility, for lack of a better term. And I just want to briefly sketch out some of the things that we discovered, particularly some of the things we learned from the documents in Moscow. First of all, look at what we call the gestation period. As many of you in this room know, the Great War, the First World War, threw up an enormously convulsive change in the American radical movement. Split the Socialist Party into two wings. One wing basically supporting the war, opposing or at least being hesitant and even negative about the Russian Revolution. The other wing embracing the revolution and opposing the war, the left wing. The left wing split from the Socialist Party and in 1919 formed the Communist Movement in two separate parties. Initially, this movement generally reflected the attitude of the old socialist movement on issues of race, not seeing any particular special character to the sufferings of peoples of African descent in American society, and more or less echoing the rather famous dictum of the great Eugene Debs, who is really the saint of American socialism, one of the very few people, actually, in our radical tradition who is not subjected to severe criticism, but echoing Debs's position that we have nothing special to offer the Negro. The Negro will rise as the working class rises. And the American Communist Movement generally adopted that position initially. However, at the same time, there was a radicalizing process that was going on within the black community, particularly in Harlem, particularly around a Harlem intelligentsia, mainly but not exclusively people of West Indian heritage, who came from the islands of the West Indies with a very fierce sense of race and color, coming from a society in which the majority were blacks, a great degree of assertiveness, coming from utterly colonial education given by the British, but educations which were far in advance of what many native African American blacks had experienced in the deeply racist post-Civil War South. And among those people was someone who forms the centerpiece of the early part of this book, who died in 1967, a man named Cyril Valentine Briggs, who came from St. Kitts and Nevis in the islands, who worked for a number of years as an editorial writer and journalist for the New York Amsterdam News, the major black newspaper of Harlem, and who in 1917, very taken by Woodrow Wilson and Wilson's promise of self-determination for peoples liberated from the yoke of colonialism as a result of the struggles to make the world safe for democracy, Briggs posed the question, if Wilson talks about self-determination for the Poles and the Czechs and others in the Balkans, why not self-determination for African people? And on that basis, Briggs launched a publication called The Crusader, which had a race catechism, talked about the greatness of Africa, talked about what he called the communist tradition in Africa, of native communal societies of sharing, claiming that was the African tradition, claiming that he would spread the glories and the beauty of Africa, which had been crushed by 19th century imperialism, to spread that beauty to young people of African descent, and all young people, for that matter, of all races. And so Briggs launched the Crusader and became part of a Harlem scene where, among other things, there was a club of black socialists, which also split, a group of black socialists gravitating toward the communist movement, particularly two young men, again from the West Indies, one named Cyril Huisewood and one named Hendricks, Arthur Hendricks. Hendricks dies before the founding, or from tuberculosis, actually, before the founding of the Communist Party. Huisewood goes on, actually, perhaps to be the very first black recruit to the party. In 1919, March of 1919, Cyril Briggs, who's increasingly part of this radical group, reads the call of Lenin's Third Internationale for peoples under the colonial yoke, peoples of color all over the world, to join hands with the working class to transform world society, extending a hand to colonial peoples and welcoming them as indispensable allies, language that Briggs had never heard before in the socialist movement, which he actually personally had never joined. Huisewood, Hendricks were, of course, part of the left wing of the Socialist Party. In the fall of 1919, Cyril Briggs announces in The Crusader that he's forming a secret order. You may ask, what's so secret about announcing it publicly? But his secret order was called the African Blood Brotherhood. And we've now learned a lot about the African Blood Brotherhood. It initially combined elements of African nationalism, of a growing sense of identity with the working class, of a tremendous sense of kinship with Lenin's Internationale and the Russian Revolution. And over time, and I'm going to move very sketchily, I hope this is not shamelessly self-serving, but I invite you to read the book where we go into more detail on this. Over time, Cyril Briggs does something that is absolutely unprecedented in the history of American radicalism and had an impact on black radical relations and on the course of the black freedom movement, in which many in that movement are unaware even, for the century to come, the half century to come. Namely, Briggs was the first one to take radical nationalism, the sense that blacks must define themselves, must create themselves, must stand on their own two feet, must fight their battles themselves, but join that concept with revolutionary internationalism. And in a key editorial that he wrote in late 1920 in The Crusader, he lays out the foundation for an alliance between this radical nationalism and working class-based revolutionary internationalism. basically merging this nationalism with the vision of socialism, because he argues there in that editorial that self-determination for African peoples in the modern world, confronting the powers of great industrial capitalist states, can never achieve their liberation unless they join forces with what he called the great socialist commonwealth. And that socialist commonwealth, struggling to transform society in this convulsive 20th century, will guarantee the basis for the freedom of African states. And I may add parenthetically, by the way, I wasn't even aware of the importance of all this until my own first trip to the Soviet Union in 1973. And some people in a very large and very diverse American delegation to a huge peace congress was circulating a petition protesting Soviet treatment of dissidents. And I stood 20 feet from these two people with the petition who approached the delegation from South Africa and asked the South Africans to sign the petition. And the South Africans, in their characteristically good-humored nature, in the face of unspeakable atrocities committed against them, began to smile and patted the people on the back and said, "We are for justice and we are for decency and we think petitions are very good, but we can't sign your petition right now." "Why?" He says, "Well," they smiled again, "you know, you in the United States give us very important support with your divestment programs and your campaigns to identify with our struggles in South Africa, and we deeply appreciate that." But then he smiled slyly again. He said, "But the Russians give us guns." And, you know, that's not, of course, precisely what Cyril Briggs had in mind. But it's that part of a 20th century dynamic that Cyril Briggs grasped way back in 1920, which kept him and a small group of African Americans active in the American communist movement during that period, despite the fact that the communist movement itself at that time was overwhelmingly foreign-born, was riven largely into different ethnic confederations, many of whom did not speak English, lived within their own rather insular ethnic communities. You know, American society, as we well know, has changed dramatically in the last 75 years. And there was a distinct problem, I think we uncovered in this study, that made things very difficult for the black communists. The ethnic groups lived a very powerful contradiction. On the one hand, they wanted to maintain their ethnic insularity, which in many respects was admirable, because they wanted to keep alive their language, their culture, their music, their various types of traditions embodied in the foods they ate, the restaurants they developed, the halls, the cultural centers, etc. On the other hand, they wanted to be American, and they had a certain ferret-like sense of what it is to try to become American. And the first thing they noticed, and they kind of absorbed that, like almost by osmosis, was the notion that racial exclusiveness is as American, if you'll pardon the expression, as cherry pie. And so, on the one hand, that combination of ethnic exclusiveness and associating racism with their certain contradictory desire to assimilate, throughout the 1920s, created tremendous problems for blacks who were turned away from workers' halls, and who were told in one famous instance in 1931, when a group of blacks came for a dance at the Finnish Hall in white Harlem, no, your dance is in black Harlem, you know, that kind of thing. So they struggled with this, but they held on. And interestingly enough, and this is something not much understood by scholars, I might add, who really have just butchered this whole development. They saw, in the international scope of the communist movement, succor, as it were, help, as it were. When a man named Otto Hall was approached by his younger brother named Haywood Hall, who later transmogrified into Harry Haywood, and played a central role in the development of the concept of Negro question as a national question, which we'll get to in a moment. When Haywood said, I'd like to join your party, his older brother said, there's too much racism in the party, but don't worry, we're going to the Comintern. He says, and this Comintern is going to straighten out this party on the question of racial equality. And Harry Haywood, in his own autobiography, writes, he was very impressed by this, that there was some kind of international organization. You know, it's kind of almost akin to saying, I'm going to go to Rome, and the Pope's going to straighten this out. There's a certain kind of schematic similarity there. By 1925, however, the country had become deeply conservative. A massive attack upon the trade union movement. The numbers of active unionists declining. The great industrial strikes of 1919, led by William Z. Forster, defeated. And the growing sense of radical nationalism in the black community truncated, somewhat cut off, by a new propulsion to assimilate into American middle-class society. With that, the African Blood Brotherhood dissolves after some important but limited successes. And the communist movement, from within the United States, with the acquiescence of the Comintern, decides to form an organization called the American Negro Labor Congress in 1925. With the idea that this Congress would be a great coalition of unions and individuals and would be designed to ram open the doors of a racist, exclusive trade union movement to blacks. And by the same token, to win blacks to the union movement, which they distrusted very deeply because of the exclusive racist character of those unions. In the five-year history, however, of the American Negro Labor Congress, it had some interesting battles. It supported nut and date workers in various rural areas. Most interesting, it supported the battle of black projectionists to form a union in the movie houses of Harlem. And it did a number of things that were noteworthy. It supported the crew of a ship called the Vestris, which began to sink in the Caribbean during a storm. And the black members of the crew, mainly firemen doing the most onerous duties, of course, were accused of cowardice. And the American Negro Labor Congress came to their support and organized rallies. And in their typically sectarian manner, and they said, hey, if the black crew of the Vestris wanted to let some of those white upper class people on this cruise drown, so be it. That's the class struggle. But by 1930, a deep, almost innate narrowness and sectarianism and the American Negro Labor Congress finally did it in. The person to emerge, fascinating, interesting man, unlike many of the others, did not come out of Harlem, but came out of the Midwest. Man named Lovett Fort Whiteman had gone to Tuskegee Institute, had been a professional actor, was a highly skilled journalist, was native born. Fort Whiteman began kind of to supersede the predominantly West Indian group that formed the first kind of African-American core of the Communist Party. Fort Whiteman, however, was passionately in love with the Soviet Union. He loved to wear rabushkas, Russian peasant blouses, And you can imagine Fort Whiteman floating around the south side of Chicago, this rather unsightly, strange figure, tall, handsome man in a Russian peasant blouse, preaching revolution. At the founding convention, for instance, of the American Negro Labor Congress, which according to the documents and the commentary, you've got letters from Huiswood and others begging the Comintern to intercede with the American Communists to see that this is a broad, inclusive movement that does not put the stamp of a young, gestating Communist Party on this movement, that welcomes everybody, that gives voice to everybody, that treats people equally. But Fort Whiteman, at the founding meeting of the American Negro Labor Congress, gets up and says, "I have something wonderful to announce. A group of black young people has been selected for revolutionary training in Moscow and will soon be leaving to study Marxism-Leninism at the University of the Toilers of the East, which had been established to educate young revolutionaries of various stripes in 1922. As a matter of fact, we found the documents in the Comintern archive of black young people who suffered terribly through those Russian winters, who couldn't get used to the food, who suffered from difficult sanitary conditions, who couldn't understand or relate to the cultural habits of young people who came from highly underdeveloped countries in Asia and Africa. And yet at the same time, these young people plucked out of the ghettos and many out of the backwaters of American society, perhaps more than 100 in total, who went through the university in Toilers, and some who even moved up, like Harry Haywood, to the more prestigious Lenin School, they rubbed shoulders with people like Ho Chi Minh and Kim Il-sung and Jomo Kenyatta and writers, people who went on to become leading figures in the great tides of national liberation in the 20th century. It's a remarkable thing, actually. But by 1928, the progress of the American Communist movement in building a base among blacks, in offering something better than rising with the working class, simply wasn't developing. And in 1928, at the 6th Congress of the Communist International, a major reconsideration of the theoretical aspects, as it was called, of the Negro question in the United States was on the table. For 25 years, I've been looking for documents that would describe what went on at that Congress and how this rather strange for its time concept that blacks in the South, in an arc of counties from the Tidewater in Virginia to the cotton fields of East Texas, constituted an oppressed nation within a nation with the national right of self-determination. And for 25 years, people kept saying, "Oh yeah, there are documents," but nobody had ever seen them. I even recruited kind of notorious anti-communist historian Theodore Draper, who told me that he had once seen a document but couldn't locate it, couldn't remember it. In any case, we found, and this was, you know, I'm not much of a researcher, but I have to tell you, it was an absolutely thrilling day when we find a 78-page stenographic transcript, word for word, in English, of the entire debate. And debate it was. For those who think that the communist movement was always riven by 100% hands going up, by the demand for unanimity, that was not the character of its origins or its early development. Even as Stalin increased his grip on the Soviet Communist Party and in many respects on the world movement, in 1928, debates still went on. And those debates were heated. As a matter of fact, the founder, the leader of the International Labor Defense at the very first meeting is confronted with two very young people, Harry Haywood, who is all of about 27 years old, And a young Siberian named Nazanov, who had spent some time in the United States, was interested in the national question. And the head of the International Labor Defense gets up and says, "Who in the hell appointed you guys, the experts on this? Why do I have to sit here and listen to a couple of self-appointed pseudo-experts tell me what to think?" You know, that was the tenor of much of that discussion. Heated, contentious, votes taken, votes very close, but ultimately, through a complex constellation of circumstances, which I'll skip over, again suggest that you read the book. That's the last time I'll spread that subliminal message, I promise. That's not fair. Not fair to you. But in any case, the Congress, through a coalition, so to speak, of Russians who wanted it and Americans who supported William Z. Foster and Alexander Biddleman against the other faction, the Lovestone faction, prevailed. And the concept that blacks in the South constituted an oppressed national minority, having been frozen out of the American mainstream by the crushing of Reconstruction at the end of Civil War, having been marginalized and isolated from the rest of American society, blacks in the Deep South had adopted all the characteristics of a nation, and for them, the political slogan has to be the right of national self-determination up to and including physical separation from the United States if that is their democratic will. And further, much misunderstood by scholars, this is not a black state. Whites were invited, albeit urged, to stay and to help build that state. Echo, by the way, of the position of South African communists, no accident, by the way, that the American problem, so-called, and the South African problem, because at that time, the South African Communist Party was completely controlled by Eastern European skilled workers, predominantly of Jewish background, who had resisted to that time the building of a strong South African Communist Party among the native blacks. And so the Comintern stepped in and told them that they had to advocate, as they called it there, a native black republic. Again, a society built on multiracial, not racialist principles. And that, by the way, the SACP strongly influenced the African National Congress. Didn't never dominated it, never controlled it, but influenced it. Influenced it largely, by the way, I might add parenthetically, because communists in South Africa, when they joined the African National Congress, never formed a faction, never formed a bloc, never attempted to take over, but functioned as individuals and even ran against each other in elections. And that gained the respect and trust of people who get very uncomfortable with militant and self-contained political movements that move into larger organizations and, you know, they reasonably think they're going to be taken over. Well, what can we make of this doctrine of self-determination? I argue in the book that it was not to be, because these folks, among other things, were not reading their Lenin properly. True, Lenin granted that certain groups around the world were developing as embryonic nations. But Lenin had also said in his Statistics and Sociology, made the brilliant observation, having studied the United States, unlike a lot of other people who are making proclamations for the United States, that nowhere in the world does the rapid development of an industrial system sweep away national differences and pull national groups into the vortex of a unified capitalist society than in the United States of America. The fact of the matter is the economic foundations, as it were, for black self-determination did not exist, never developed, and therefore it's not accidental that as the civil rights movement emerged in the 1950s, the so-called concept of integration, of assimilation on the basis of equality, became the controlling theme of the movement. with a sub-theme, which I'll get into if I have time, which talked about the whole concept of, you know, separatism. In any case, though, that was not the issue with the development of self-determination. That is the issue of a separate black state. The question was, really, did the communists hit upon something that touched a powerfully sensitive nerve, both in African-American life and the life of the nation as a whole? The answer is yes, because the yearnings, the struggle for self-definition, the desire to have one's own voice, the desire to link with the rest of American society while preserving and protecting and advancing one's own culture was part of the notion of oppressed nationality. And there was something else about that concept which had a very, very powerful effect. That is the idea that a people in the South, by the way, blacks in the North were to struggle for assimilation and equality. The national question was a Southern question. But the very idea of having a nationally oppressed people who are oppressed not just by race, not just by economics, not just by politics, not just by culture, not just by denial of the right to their own psychological makeup, but by all those factors. That concept drove communists, as one person said to me, he said, you know, when we saw that, it was like a wandering high beam spotlight that magnified this terrible suffering that even the most sensitive among us did not understand. Further, by elevating the concept of national self-determination to the Leninist lexicon, so to speak, the battle for equality and liberation of black people became second to none in the programmatic struggle to effect the change in American society. And that was the dynamic which, on the eve of the Great Depression, which was about to change fundamental aspects of American politics, led the American Communist Movement into one of the most intensive, fervent, unrelenting struggles for racial equality that this nation had ever seen, indeed had not seen, until the abolitionist movement in the United States of the 19th century. Interestingly enough, the persistence of racism, the incident that I talked about before of turning blacks away from a hall, eventuated in March 1931 with a famous, or if you prefer, infamous trial of August Jokinen, the Finnish janitor who turned these blacks away from the Finnish hall. And that began a whole series of so-called anti-chauvinist trials, which were, I mean, many whites and many blacks looked at this and said, my God, what is going on here? We've never seen anything like that. The Chicago Defender, a very conservative newspaper, looked at the expulsion of a communist party from a movement that he deeply, deeply believed in Milwaukee, because he said Negroes are lazy, they don't want to work, and they don't get organized. And the Chicago Defender said, my God, this movement separated a man from something that was part of his life for saying something that we Negroes say to each other every day. He says, this is really remarkable. And the Jokinen trial, Harlem Casino, packed with 1,500 people. Our perfect symmetry, a black defense attorney, a white prosecutor. The black, usually Richard B. Moore, remarkable, remarkable orator. Some of you in this room, I'm sure, have heard Richard Moore. Many called him the black Daniel Webster. After I read some of his speeches, I said, no. I got it confused. But in any case, Daniel Webster perhaps was the white Richard B. Moore, because that was the impact of his speech, of his ability to speak. I asked Harry Haywood once, I said, weren't those trials contrived? Weren't they just rigged? And Harry Haywood said to me, of course they were contrived. He looks at me and says, what the hell you think this is? He says, no, this is no bourgeois court. We're trying to make a political point. Well, by 1934, the political point is over because the trials is Hayward himself, who is kind of a progenitor of all this stuff. Hayward says, the trials had become a substitute for real struggle. But real struggle went on. And that real struggle was something that is absolutely incredible. First of all, in the Deep South, and I have chapters on this, I won't repeat it, but in the Deep South, the organization of the Sharecroppers Union in Lowndes and Tallapoosa and other counties in Alabama meant that people were attacked for being members of the Sharecroppers Union, of trying to get 50 cents a day, you know, for a bale of cotton, largely assaulted, brutalized, beaten, families scattering into the woods. An investigator from a liberal organization coming in 1931 to Alabama and saying, the dead are out there. We don't even know who they are. The families are even afraid to admit that they have buried their own relatives in the deep woods where their bones rest to this very day. And of course, the Scottsboro case, which many of you are familiar with. Herbert Benjamin, who was the leader of the unemployed councils, told me a story which might be familiar to you. He said, to kind of convey the intensity of the Scottsboro campaign, in which he said, we once had a delegation go to a landlord in the Bronx. And the landlord in the Bronx, besieged by the delegation, threw his hands up and said, all right, I'll get you new garbage cans, and I'll paint the halls, and I'll call in, you know, a somebody to fumigate the place. I'll do all that, but for God's sakes, I can't free the Scottsboro boys. There was one aspect, and that's the only aspect I'll talk about here, of the Scottsboro case that was missed, frankly, by the others, and I don't mean to lord over them, who have studied Scottsboro ad infinitum. Of the nine boys, and they were boys in ages from 12 to 19, who were framed and set for execution, except the two 12-year-olds, only one, Hayward Patterson, had a living father, which gives you a sense of mortality in the Black South at that time. The International Labor Defense approached the mothers of these boys to win control of the case. And they said, look, we can't promise in these courts in the South that we will win freedom from your boys through the legal system. We can promise you that worldwide protest, or street heat as they call it today, unrelenting, persistent protest, will win the freedom of those boys, and we have a movement, and we will summon that movement in every corner of the world to work for the liberation of your sons. And they came to them and called them misses, and treated them as equals, and treated them with respect. On the other hand, I found in the papers, and I don't mean to be overly critical, but I found in the papers of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People letters by Walter White and Dean William Pickens, who were the main forces in attempting to wrest the case away from the ILD. They would refer to the mothers, and I quote, as dumb, dense animals. They would refer to the mothers as stupid, poor, ignorant people who, quote, would believe anything a white man tells them, unquote, which, by the way, was not fully accurate because many of the organizers who dealt directly, William L. Patterson in the first place, were black. But it occurred to me, and I say this in the book, and I think I'm probably going to get a lot of criticisms for this, that at certain junctures where race and class intersect, that there are critical moments when the unity of class transcends the identity of race. Doesn't happen all the time, but it happens often enough to make you think very hard about what kind of synthesis we need to create a unified progressive movement in this country. I'll conclude this point. Very little to go, running over. But I'll conclude this point with a sense, really, of a little portion of the book, of the magnitude of the movement and the various aspects of the movement. And I start by talking about the South Side of Chicago, which had the strongest Communist Party group, where hundreds of blacks joined, that is, among blacks, Communist Party among blacks. And what of the hundreds on the South Side who joined the party in the heat of anti-eviction protests? Michael Gold, writing in the Daily Worker, admitted that, quote, some of them have been driven away. The party in America has not yet worked out some simple, consistent plan that would hold such masses, unquote. Often the problem was simply the internal tedium of party life, which was at least as much a part of being a communist as excitement of confrontation at eviction sites. To be a revolutionary required paying dues and special assessments for the South, for example, distributing the party's press, working in mass organizations, check up on various financial and press circulation quotas, building audiences for public events, mobilizing people for demonstrations, participating in, quote, educationals, unquote, enduring, quote, criticism and self-criticism, unquote. This huge commitment of time and energy became too much for many blacks and whites after the heat and passion of a given struggle faded. Many left not with anger or recrimination, but because the normal rhythms of life did not allow for the abnormal rhythms of a revolutionary existence. Sometimes a change in lifestyle, getting a job, leaving the city, getting married, having a child, becoming ill, or just losing interest, was cause for an exit. What of those blacks who remained? Many who were recruited in the early and mid-30s stayed for months and years. Sylvia Wood, Claude Lightfoot, Nate Sharp, and others remained communists for their lifetimes. Despite a high turnover, the South Side section of the party in the early 30s began to take on the cultural expression, texture, and even the cadences of black life that had been largely transported from the Mississippi Delta to Chicago. As it had for the blacks recruited in Birmingham, Marxist theory offered a compelling explanation for the exploitation and discrimination felt throughout Chicago's black belt. Some members, like Lightfoot and Ishmael Florey, contributed to the theoretical development of the party's evolving policies. Richard Wright, for more than a decade, was the party's most prominent literary figure and articulator of the emotional component of national oppression. Lightfoot tells of Harry Haywood coming to the South Side in 1932 as a representative of the National Organization's Negro Department. He appeared at a large section meeting with all the, quote, authority, unquote, and inflexibility of his years at the Lenin School. Haywood had come to expel Poindexter. David Poindexter was a remarkable man, the father of the man, by the way, who was on the run with Angela Davis back in the 70s. Poindexter for some sort of deviation. In his party monotone, Haywood laid out the particulars. Comrade Poindexter did this. Comrade Poindexter acted without the party's approval. Comrade Poindexter did that, and on and on. There was a stir in the hall. A woman cried out, "Oh Lord, the party's going to expel Poindexter." There were signs, sighs and discordant sounds from Poindexter's admirers, especially women. Poindexter responded, "If my party sees fit to sever me from the revolutionary movement which I have served so faithfully, so be it. If I soil communist principles while leading the unemployed, while fighting for relief, while standing at the citadels of power and demanding justice for the working class, while, voice rising, Comrade Haywood was studying at the Lenin School, so be it, so be it." At this point, shouts of indignation and support for Poindexter filled the hall. Haywood turned to the section leaders and signaled a retreat for consultation. Later, Haywood reappeared to announce that in view of Comrade Poindexter's self-criticism, the party would withdraw its charges. Poindexter's celebrated rhetoric and the audience's responses, punctuated with yes, tell it, and amen, were not to say the least typical of party meetings, but they had become typical on the South Side, where, according to Lightfoot, section meetings often took on the sounds and spiritual tension of a Delta revival. 3 weeks after the mass funeral, the Chicago Communists were back at it. This time at United Charities, where they demanded relief, the battle for relief had a directness and urgency second to none. Typical of the street politics of relief was an incident in Harlem in 1931, when a crowd stormed the relief station after being exhorted at a street meeting of the local unemployed council. The demonstrators complained about the plight of Negro women who were forced to wait for hours to apply for non-existent menial jobs. The fury of relief agency protests sometimes spilled into courtrooms. On September 2, 1932, 30 communists and supporters shouted their outrage at sentences handed out to two people who had been in the middle of a disturbance at the Harlem Relief Bureau. A white woman, Eleanor Henderson, wife of the Columbia University instructor, was given 10 days in jail. Sam Brown, a Negro, received 6 months on the same charge. Mrs. Henderson reportedly was among the first to condemn this unequal punishment as a racist caricature of justice. In November 1932, a 27-year-old mother of four children was buried on Long Island after a mass funeral at the Harlem Workers Center, sponsored by the Harlem Unemployed Council. The party claimed that Mrs. Estelle Smith, her husband, and four small children, one of them an infant, had been denied relief by charity agencies and were forced to live on an 11 cents a day given them by the Home Relief Bureau. A diet of cabbage and beans, along with the burden of caring for her family during pregnancy, had seriously weakened Mrs. Smith by the time she bore her fourth child. Communists in Harlem charged that she was mistreated and neglected while in the hospital. She died shortly after the birth of her child. At her coffin, blacks and whites pledged to avenge her death by organizing to destroy hunger and starvation. On December 22, 1932, the communists found the body of a Negro man in an abandoned building on West 40th Street in Manhattan. The building for some time had been home to assorted vagrants, some of whom had joined the New York Unemployed Councils. The unemployed man was given the name Skippy Baritone, and a combined protest march and funeral procession was organized. Behind the hearse, carriers bore a placard that read, "He died of starvation." Flanked by a huge red flag, other signs charged the city commissioner of welfare with complicity in Skippy's death. Never found out, by the way, why they called him Skippy Baritone. As the cortege led by the Red Front Band made its way through the Garment District to Union Square, the now anticipated confrontation with police erupted. Skippy Baritone was laid to rest at a funeral ground owned by a party affiliate in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Queens. For the party, Skippy Baritone had been rescued from the dust and ashes of his own decay. In death, the humanity, identity, and dignity of all black men and women who lived and died as anonymous outcasts were reaffirmed. I'll end simply by pointing out that the rest of the book goes on to discuss the changes wrought by the coming of the New Deal, by the broadening out and great anti-fascist unity through the Popular Front, the formation of the National Negro Congress in 1936, which represented the very height of the unity of white radicals and blacks and the building of a very broad national organization that fought against lynching, that successfully wooed hundreds of thousands of black workers to the trade union, the new industrial trade union movement. And I conclude simply with this. Today, despite the impressive growth of the African American middle class, institutional racism remains a tenacious factor in American society. It is underscored repeatedly by statistical comparisons between blacks and whites. From infant mortality to the impoverishment of children, to disparities in employment, health, unemployment, employment, health care, housing, net financial assets, and prison populations, the oppressive effects of discrimination against African Americans are manifest and continue to constitute the foundation for all forms of racial, ethnic, and national discrimination. The global economy and the accompanying restructuring of production in the United States has had a particularly devastating impact upon African American youth. The global race to the bottom in search of cheap labor, combined with the diminishing of old industries, has left black youth, among many others, at the lowest rungs of non-union employment, serving food, pumping gas, washing dishes, or entirely out of the labor market, often left to survive in an insulated shadow economy beyond the law. That isolation has engendered among many black working class youth a discontinuity with the political consciousness that swept over much of black America from the 1930s through the struggles of the 1960s and beyond. Such a situation only deepens the need to make known the historical record of the 1930s and to lay it before new generations. The long road to freedom of African Americans today is dotted with literally thousands of initiatives to combat the consequences of racism and discrimination. And within the marrow of that continuing fight is the legacy of the interface of blacks and reds in the 1930s, the scores killed and wounded in anti-eviction protests, strikes, and demonstrations, the disappeared sharecroppers, the struggles to build an interracial foundation for a new labor movement, the campaigns for justice from the courts. Of greatest importance, perhaps, is the living legacy of black women and men who seized upon the proffer from the left to act upon their own militant instincts, to build their own organizations, and to solidify the democratic content of their struggles, which ultimately depended upon their own resources and upon the initiatives of ordinary working people. Whatever the short-term advantages of privilege derived by whites from discrimination, the communist case for the long-term fatal damage of racial injustice to white working class interests still resonates. The existence of a low-wage or no-wage population at the bottom rungs of the economic ladder creates a downward pull on the economic fortunes of all workers at a time of dissolving industrial jobs and lingering wage stagnation. The siren song of racial resentment is played often deafeningly by conservatives to gain political advantage, which they then use to broadly undermine progressive values. The division of working people and the poor among racial lines continues to be the most serious barrier to a resurgent movement for a more equitable and democratic distribution of wealth and power. We are left finally with two images that symbolize the passionate beliefs that constitute the heart of this story. One is the image of Rose Chernin as she was interviewed by the author in a nearly bare office in Los Angeles in 1973. Small, pencil thin, with large, glowing eyes, she relived with a rare fusion of serenity and fire. That moment in 1932, when a party leader warned that white communists were only, quote, treading water, unquote, without the Negro people, and must be ready to sacrifice their lives if necessary to build solidarity. The other image is of Claude Whitefoot, sitting in a small house in the shadow of a closed steel plant in Gary, Indiana, in 1974. He told of the legendary black organizer, John Henry Johnson, who faced a hostile crowd of white packing house workers in Amarillo, Texas, in the mid-1930s. Johnson pressed on, talking union. Lightfoot lowered his voice to capture the drama of Johnson's final gambit. Over and over, the organizer intoned, "Food on the table for black babies and white babies. Black babies and white babies. Black babies and white babies." Lightfoot's admiring laugh expressed his undying awe at an organizer's skills and perhaps reflected his own wonder about the multitude of struggles that had been fought on a long and continuing journey to liberation. The fight was not over. and the craving and the cry for unity were not extinguished. Thank you.
You have been listening to another edition of Talking History. This segment was produced by the Department of History, University at Albany. Talking History is a co-production of the History Department, University at Albany, State University of New York, WRPI FM Troy, and the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska. For more information about Talking History, write Talking History, Department of History, University at Albany, 1400 Washington Avenue, Albany, New York, 12222.